Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
To our new listeners, welcome. To our old listeners, welcome back. Another episode of Magical Education awaits you, but first we would like to say a few words.
Nitwit, blubber, oddment, tweak. Podcast 9¾, topic of the week is Australian Magical History. Hi there, listeners. I'm Jem.
And I'm Rhea. And I'd like to start this episode by talking to you at length about a problem that I have.
Okay. Let's go. Oh, quickly, we'll just do a content warning.
Oh, yes. Content warning. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, as you all know, this is our Australian Magical series, and this episode we'll be talking about Australian Magical History, which looks at the history of this country through the context of a magical lens, specifically the magic and Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. So, for anyone who isn't aware, Australia's history is very dark. We have a very complex and gruesome and at times terrible history mm-hmm. to hear about. We'll be covering topics such as genocide, colonization. And so if these are topics that you are not comfortable hearing about, mm-hmm. that is fine. I just recommend you skip this episode.
And also, I want to specifically mention any Indigenous Australians who might be listening. We're going to talk about specific things like the Stolen Generations, which might be
yeah.
very upsetting to hear about. So if you don't want to listen to this episode, or just be aware that we're going to talk about those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to open by talking about something that I've talked to you about outside of the podcast a few times, and mm-hmm. it's a problem within the series of Harry Potter that I don't know how to solve and I don't think can be solved. And it's mm-hmm. the clash between fantasy and historical fantasy and historical revisionism.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got like a thing that I'm going to walk you through. This might take a while, but I think it's important to spell it out.
Yeah.
So what's Harry Potter? Harry Potter is a children's series which asks the question, what if there was a secret magical world that existed within the world around us?
Yeah.
That, at its base premise, is a premise for a children's series about children who go to a magical school and have fun adventures. It's fine. It doesn't have to mm-hmm. be deeper than that. We don't have to think about it. But the problem comes when we do try and make it deeper and we do try and think about it. Mm-hmm. When we try to expand that premise out to cover not just this tiny slice of white upper middle class Britain, but the entire world with all of its many cultures and races and stories, this is where we're going to run into problems.
Yeah.
So this is the problem I want to talk about, and, like, heads up, I might say some things that you might find upsetting or not like, but this is important context before we start talking about Australian magical history. The problem with the Harry Potter series is a fantasy story which appears to be set in our modern world. By its very nature, it supposes that the fantastical elements of the world had no significant impact on the world throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like Narnia, where the children leave their dreary little British lives and they escape to what is effectively a parallel reality to have their adventures. Harry and the other wizards are living in our world, with our politics and our history, which means mm-hmm. that wizards and magic and magical creatures have always existed, and yet every major historical event since the dawn of time has taken place exactly as it did in our world. This mm-hmm. is even canon. We even see it in the series. There's a section where Harry's reading about the Salem witch trials, a horrific tragedy where, like, real-life women and men as well, but mostly women, were, like, tortured and murdered because they were supposed to be witches. And, like, we mm-hmm. know in the world of Harry Potter, real-life witches were there with magic and they did nothing about it, and it all played out exactly the same as it did because they just yep. didn't do anything. Yeah, okay.
Yep.
So this makes no sense. Because in our world, like, horrible things happened because magic didn't exist to solve or at least impact the problems of the time. So it's the question of, and we've mentioned this a million times, and so has every other person who's ever criticized Harry Potter, why didn't wizards stop the Holocaust?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, they were busy doing something else. Oh, they couldn't interfere for legal or political reasons. Yeah, but what about every other massacre and genocide and invasion and colonization, mm-hmm. and the massive centuries-long travesty and miscarriage of justice? Every single one of them that has taken place since the dawn of time. Why didn't wizards do anything about slavery? About smallpox? They could mm-hmm. have. They have the power to do things and solve those problems, but they just didn't.
Yeah.
And the only answer that makes sense in canon is either that they choose not to, which makes them complicit.
Yeah.
Or they were active participants in these things, which makes them... more sense and yeah. is worse.
It's...
It makes them more than complicit. It makes them malicious.
Yeah. I think it's depending on the time and place, a little from column A, a little from column B. It's both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for me, this, like, thought process was prompted by the Ilvermorny update years yes. ago.
Yeah.
It was something I thought about at the time, and I always intended to bring it up on the podcast as part of a larger conversation about representation, but it was never the right moment. This is the moment. I'm making the moment now.
Yeah.
So, when the Ilvermorny update came out, J.K. Rowling was slammed for racism, cultural appropriation, and general ignorance and lack of sensitivity
mm-hmm.
when she released info about the American Wizarding School and the American Wizarding World, and specifically the treatment of Native American people, history, and culture.
Yeah.
All of those criticisms are fair and reasonable. She yes. did a bad job. She is, on the whole, not good at depicting anything other than white British people with anything even close to sensitivity or yeah. nuance. And she's too arrogant to admit that she's bad at that, or anything she says isn't perfect, so she won't accept help.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. But beyond JK's many problems, there is a larger problem that exists within the world of Harry Potter, and it isn't an issue about how representation is handled, and it isn't a plot hole that can be written around. It's a fundamental problem that can't be solved.
Yeah.
So, the history of the human race is bloody and violent and filled with cruelty and injustice and tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Now and throughout history, we can divide the world into oppressor and oppressed. And it's not a clean division, but these things exist.
Sure.
The reason why this is possible is because oppressed people have historically, culturally, socially, militarily, economically, and by any other means you want to judge, had less power than the people who oppressed them.
Yeah.
The systems and mechanisms by which this has happened are many and varied, and I'm not just talking about one thing. I'm talking about race, gender, monarchies, military campaigns, empires. I'm talking about everything all yep. over the world since time began. There are people with power, and there are people without. And that means different things in different places and times measured in different ways.
Yes.
Now, when you add into that mix another system of power, magical power, there's yep. only two possible ways to do that. One, this new system of power disrupts all the other systems. Like, if you had all these systems in place but without money, and then you threw economy into the mix, that changes everything.
Of course.
You understand?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or two, it has absolutely no effect and it changes nothing, which means that the new system of power aligns itself to existing systems of power.
Which I think is what's happened.
Which is what happened.
Yeah.
So, to unpack what I just said a little bit, the first option would be historical fantasy. I'm going to mention the Stolen Generations here, which is something we'll explain more as the episode goes on.
Yeah.
But the Stolen Generations, a real-life tragedy, happened in Australia because white people had the power to steal the children of Indigenous people.
Yes.
Now, if Indigenous people had magical power to resist or repel white people, the Stolen Generations either wouldn't have happened or would have happened very, very differently.
Yeah.
So to depict that in the world of Harry Potter would be historical revisionism or historical fantasy. It would be rewriting the actual history of the world to look different based on different factors like the introduction of magic.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Potter doesn't do this. Mm-hmm. What Harry Potter does is introduce this new system of power to the world, but then also says the world is exactly the same as it is now.
Yep.
Which means that magical power must align to historical and current systems of power. So in short, white people and white British people were able to colonize and oppress non-white people because their magic was more powerful than the magic of Indigenous people they were oppressing. This is the way it has to be. It's the only logical possible answer within the context of the story. And that sucks, and it's racist, but it's because the world we live in is racist. And there isn't a way to fix it without writing all evil out of the world, which also doesn't fix the problem, because that's how you get... All wizards are separate and they don't concern themselves with the politics of muggles, and there's actually no way to fix this.
I hate it.
Yeah.
I also... yeah.
Do you,
I see where you're
coming
from.
Did everything that I just said make sense?
It does make sense.
Okay.
But I hate it because I think it also comes with this assumption that, if I'm looking at this from an Australian lens, it comes with an assumption that, like, the reason why the white colonization of Australia was successful was because Britain was simply just more powerful than Indigenous peoples, which I think is maybe a, like, obviously not a nuanced take. Like,
this is vastly simplified.
Yeah, it's just, obviously, it wasn't a fair game because they were introducing diseases and shit. They were, it was a purposeful genocide. It was colonization. Like, what do I even say to that? Like, I don't think it's exactly one-to-one with our history. No.
Of course it isn't. No, and it's far more complicated than that.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is, like, there is not a way to write the story and the world of Harry Potter without using, this is going to sound bad, without, like, using racist ideas and racist histories, because Harry Potter's set in the real world and history's racist.
And
that's
also
the way that it is.
The world of Harry Potter's racist. We've established this.
The world
in
of Harry
episodes.
Potter's racist as well. So you can't be like, oh, well, Australia was never colonized by the British, because that completely changes the entire history of the planet and would mean that Harry Potter's set in a completely parallel universe where things are very, very different. And it isn't. It's set in our world.
Yeah.
So Australia was colonized by the British. But why did that happen?
Yeah.
It shouldn't have. If the Indigenous peoples had magical power, why weren't they able to better protect themselves? It doesn't add up. It doesn't follow. There's no way to solve it.
So,
yeah. I had to say all of this before we start talking about the history of Australia, because there's so much. It's such a problem.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know what to say. Because, like, exactly. I've come up with a story of how I think history played out, which basically mirrors our own history, like the real history of this country. But I never tried to look at it through that lens of, like, this inherently means that British magic is simply more powerful. I never looked at it that way. I looked at it as how it played out in our history, which was, we cheated them. It was warfare and it was cruel and it was unnecessary. That's how I looked at it.
It was a war which was won.
And lost. No, the war's still going.
Yeah, it's still going.
So, like, we're still in a contested, conflict-ridden land. So that's how I viewed it. This is a grim start to the episode.
It is a grim start to the episode.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about here is because often when we do, like, our headcanons about things in Harry Potter, what we do is we're like, hey, JK said this thing, but that's racist, so we're going to fix it. We're going to do our own thing and we're going to change it and we're going to make it better. I wanted to set up in this episode, we actually can't do that without breaking the entire world. Because I would love to be like, oh, hey, the entire history of Australia and all of the horrible tragedies and everything that happened here, it didn't happen in the world of Harry Potter. It was a better, cooler, more fucking woke version of history.
And honestly, that feels worse because it's against the nature of truth-telling and reconciliation that is needed to understand the history of this country and move forward as a people in this country.
Yeah. So first of all, like, that's not my place as a white descendant of fucking immigrants and colonizers to be like, hey, it's all chill, guys. Don't even worry about it. And, like, second of all, there's no way to do that, like you said, that is truthful and just and, like, and it also straight up just doesn't make sense in the world because it is set in our real world. There's not an alternate history.
Yeah.
And we're just looking at Australia. The entire history of the planet from the dawn of time to now would be wildly different.
Oh,
if magic was real if the system of magic in Harry Potter was real in our world, it would look completely different. It just wouldn't be the same. It would be a completely different world.
Yeah. But if we're understanding, as you said, magic as just another system of power that exists in the history of this fictional reality, then, yeah, we would just put it alongside things like economy, military, etc., which is how colonization took place.
Yeah. It just has to align with the way that systems of power worked out in history. You have to assume that the Roman Empire was more magically powerful than all of the countries they conquered. It just has to be that way, because otherwise they wouldn't have conquered those countries.
Oh,
and
I hate it.
And they wouldn't have been a Roman Empire. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hate it.
Yeah. So, had to preface this episode with all of that. I wish I could fix this. I can't. There's no way to fix it. And JK can't fix it either. It's just, it's an inherent flaw within the world.
The problem with JK and what she created was that she created it from her very narrow-minded, white, British context. And I have the suspicion that she's a monarchist at heart. And so...
I wouldn't call that a suspicion. I would call that text.
Yeah. Textual. It seems quite textual that she's a monarchist at heart, and so probably didn't even... hasn't, like, had the thought cross her mind before about the impacts of British colonization on the globe.
Yeah.
So, obviously, us as two Australians are just inherently going to look at the systems and ideas that she preached in her novels completely differently to someone from a country that has never been colonized before by Britain.
Yeah.
Like...
yeah. She's probably looking at, like, oh, British colonization historically and to this day was a good thing.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
She's probably like, oh, why would Australia want to leave the Commonwealth? You know?
Yeah. Don't you love it here? Isn't it great?
Don't you love having a king?
Ugh. Anyway. Okay.
Let's
actually start talking about magical history in Australia.
Yeah. Again, we should preface... we are both white Australians standing on stolen land. We have no connection to the First Nations of this land. We are second generation immigrants. And these are our very limited perspectives on how we think history might have played out in a magical context. Of course, our perspectives would be thoroughly more enriched if we had a Indigenous co-host or a First Nations persons or perspectives enriching our storytelling here, but... that's not what we have. These are our opinions. You're welcome to adapt them, contradict them, add to them, take away from them. That is your prerogative, and we would love to hear that from, especially from our Indigenous listeners and First Nations people. So,
And we're going to do the best we can here, specifically within the limitations of real life history and the context of the story, as I've just outlined.
Yes.
There's only so much we can do here.
And there's only so much we can cover in our time limit too. Like, I've broken down Australian history literally into, like, sort of five sections, which is so limiting, but I tried to touch as many important cultural touchstones as I could. So bear that in mind as well.
Okay.
All right. So let's start this. Obviously, my first point is the oldest civilization on Earth, magic in First Nations of Australia, pre-contact. All right. I want us to think about magic users in pre-contact Australia. Purebloods, halfbloods, muggleborn, squibs, and muggles. Are these populations divided? Is magic shared amongst all? Is it ceremonial and exclusive? And then I want to think about pre-contact trade and diplomacy with other countries. So... specifically East Asia and the Dutch. There's evidence of this throughout our history. There's evidence that even Sheng He, the famous Chinese pirate, might have traded with Indigenous peoples in the north of the country. Like, it's... yeah.
<That's>
so
<sick. laughs>
these are the things let's have a think about, like, how the magic users might have operated, what their roles in society might have been, what the societies might have looked like.
You've also touched on wands and the wandless here, which I know is a massive issue, but we should address that as well. So I want to give a little bit of context first of all. So when we are talking about the Indigenous peoples of Australia, first of all, we keep using this word peoples because there was not one single unified Indigenous population. It wasn't like
not
one country with one people. Not homogenous. It was more like, I think it's something like maybe... a couple of thousand. I don't even know how many different...
over hundreds.
Like, native countries there were.
Different countries and nations. But that's why I say First Nations as well.
Nations, So, the land of Australia was basically divided up into... we're not sure how many. And we're not sure as well because I don't think there is a solid answer. It's... these things have been sort of lost to history because of many genocides. Divided into the hundreds, maybe thousands of different nations where there were different peoples living on their land. So when I think of, like, the magical community within that, I really don't see a separation between magic users and muggles in terms of the Indigenous Australians. To me, that doesn't make any sense. And it specifically doesn't make sense that there would be, like, a separate land or a separate place where magical users would live. Like a Diagon Alley type place. No. That doesn't make any sense to me.
I see it as very much immersed. Everyone knows that there are some people that are magic users. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, it's just part of the societies that exists. Like,
Yeah, you would just know that, like, your family has, like, you know, a few dozen people or something living in it, and, like, one or two of those people are magic users. Except those numbers are way off. It would be way less than that. They're just integrated into the people. And I, in terms of, like, blood purity, pure bloods and half bloods and stuff, those are incredibly, like, British ideas. I don't think so.
Definitely British. I don't think it's happening. Like,
no.
That would be something that would be introduced post-contact.
Yeah, it's going to be introduced later.
And it's going to be a problem.
It's going to be a massive problem.
Yeah. So everyone's sort of living together. They have a shared knowledge. I think there might be some, like, spells. Like, if I'm thinking about Indigenous cultures and First Nations peoples, there were some ceremonies that only certain people could attend. Like, you know, there were some things that only men could do. There was something that only women can do. Elders, etc. So I think there might be some particular, you know, magical ceremonies or rituals that are exclusive to magic users or particular types of magic users, like male magic users, female. But I think ultimately magic is a part of the community, and it's a part of the way that the nations interact with the land and with each other.
Yeah, there's things like men's business and women's business, which is like secret knowledge or secret ceremonies that was divided amongst genders that weren't shared with each other. I think I can very much see, like, magical rituals and magical ceremonies being restricted to certain peoples.
But not all of them as well, I think.
Not all of them. No, it would be certain things.
And it would vary between each nation as well. Like we said, it's not a homogenous group.
And we couldn't guess what those are because, like, us being white Australians, like, I have no idea what women's business is. It's not my business. It's I don't know anything about it.
It's not my business.
I don't know anything about it. Yeah. I would never try to learn. Yeah. I'm just aware of the systems. I want to touch on wands and wandlessness because I know that this is something that JK was slammed for in the Ilvermorny update.
This is a thing.
So in Harry Potter, like, the peak best way to use magic is to use a wand as a magical focus. And it's straight up stated in the text that, like, Native Americans didn't have wands. They used, like, ceremonial ritual magic, which was less focused and weaker than the cool white people magic of using wands. Which is built on all kinds of racist stereotypes and stuff. So I don't know. I don't feel like it's my call as a white person to make a decision on whether Indigenous peoples had wands or not.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, I would lean towards no. I don't think that. Just because it seems like it's a white British invention.
It seems like a white British invention. It seems very colonizy. It seems very masculine and phallic. It seems very aggressive. It's a weapon.
It vibes with they invented guns and then guns have spread to the rest of the world.
It really vibes with, like, it's a weapon used to seize power and control. Look, you know, Indigenous peoples and First Nations peoples had weapons that they used to hunt and for conflict. There was conflict pre-contact as well.
Of course.
So I think it would depend on the magic user. It might depend on the nation they belong to, whether or not they have wands or staffs or some sort of focus instrument. It might be a mixture of it might be depending on what, like, what you're using the magic for, what ceremony it's a part of, you know. It might be that you use a wand or some sort of focus object. It might be that it's more about wandless magic and using your hands or using dance and ceremony, using song lines. Like, there could be I like to think it's a bit of everything, and it depends, obviously, like, different parts of the country and different nations would have their own practices that they might prefer based on their own cultures. Like, I think, I like to think of lots of things. Not, like, wands is too limiting. I like to think of, like I said, song lines, dance, smoke, plants. I think of, like, I'm thinking of lots of different options, like.
Yeah. When I'm thinking of Indigenous magic, I'm thinking about, like, the many different, I guess, traditions, yeah, the different kinds of art and culture, the different ways of life that I know about Indigenous people, and I'm not an expert in this. I'm, like you mentioned, song lines. I'm thinking of, like, smoking ceremonies. I'm, mm-hmm, dance and music, massively important to, yep, Indigenous Australian peoples. Like, so much of the dreaming is told through dance and song. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, like, wooden instruments like wands, like you said, staffs, spears,
yeah,
boomerangs.
Yeah, said at the same time.
Shields. I don't know the name for them, but there's a kind of, like, rhythm stick that's used to make music in, mm-hmm, ceremonies. Mm-hmm. The name of it is escaping me. Things like those could have easily been, like, magical focuses very similar to wands.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, look, that's my answer to that. It's, yeah, not perfect, but that's what I'm going to say on that topic.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I think, like, obviously I would love to hear a more culturally informed perspective.
Yeah. So, I just, yeah, when I think of Indigenous Australian magic, I think less of spells and wand work as I think more of, like, bushcraft.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think of, like, it's just part of the culture and the experience that's woven into everyday life. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I can see, like, magic users that are just making oils that protect people from the sun. And I can see, mm-hmm, magic users that are using their magic to hunt down a kangaroo so they can feed their family, yeah, and their tribe. Like, I can just see it all connected like that. And it's just a part of the way of life. It's part of the extension of how they interact with the land and one, yeah, another. So, like, yeah, yeah, that's how I see it. But, like, you know, we're just making, yeah, assumptions here.
Yeah. I'm thinking of, like, times when I've had the opportunity to walk through the land with an Indigenous guide on, like, rare occasions, usually as touristy, yeah, sort of events, where it's like, you know, here's this place and here's what it means to us and here are the plants and here's how they can be used, mm-hmm, and here's how I would see and track animals in the area. I think all of these things in terms of, like, systems of ways of life and traditional knowledge, yeah, just having a magical aspect to them. That's the, yeah, way that I think of magic.
I also want to bring in here connections to land, people, and language. Because, yes, something that's very terrible about Australian history is that obviously there were thousands of different Indigenous languages that, yes, existed pre-contact. But because of the effects of colonization and attempted genocide, many of those languages are lost.
Countless have been lost.
Yeah, countless have been lost and completely erased. So I think I would definitely see magic users either non-verbally or definitely using their own languages to, mm-hmm, create spells and enchantments. So I think that's going to have a big impact later when, yeah, the languages are, you know, when those languages are taken away from those magic users.
Yeah. In terms of, like, language being the in terms of Latin being the magical language in Harry Potter, I'm not a linguist professor. I'm not, like, a linguist professional, but Latin is the root language for English, correct?
No, it's not. English's root language is Germanic. Latin is the root language for things like French, Spanish,
the Romantic languages.
Yeah, but Germanic is for English, so.
Okay, so then it makes no sense that that English use Latin as their magical language then.
She might have gone with Latin because it's a universal language in terms of science, so that's why all our animals have scientific names in Latin.
Okay.
It might have been her move, but I disagree. It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah. Look, I can't explain why Latin is the magic language in Harry Potter, because that doesn't make sense in terms of the English use it if it's not their root language.
Mm.
So either Latin is the magic language and it's the only language that has magic, which doesn't make sense.
Because
there was a place in time where Latin was the language that was spoken by the people.
Yeah. And also, like, I just don't agree because, like, it just doesn't make sense that, like, in China or in Nigeria or in the Caribbean, they're using Latin, yeah, languages. If, like, why would they? Unless, obviously, if they've been colonized, if they had in the Caribbean, yeah, and, you know, like
obviously,
maybe
post-colonization, yeah, makes sense. But, like, if we're saying that, like, because we've talked about where magic comes from and it comes from emotions.
Exactly.
And it started out in terms of ceremony and then it was focused and blah, but we've done all the work behind this.
Yeah.
So the reason why British people use Latin is because they have discovered that as a focus and it's become, yeah, the known system.
That's their socialization. That's their culture. Yeah. That's what they're doing. Yeah.
There's no inherent power in the syllables and letters that make up Latin. So any culture could use any language or no language and it would just make sense to them if that's the way they've been socialized to do it.
Exactly.
So, yeah, no, whatever.
These are just cultural tools, yeah.
Yeah, indigenous magical languages could have had power, or they could have had a completely different system that didn't use language at all.
Yeah, it would depend on the nation, depend on the magic user.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about contact with East Asia, like China and Indonesia and the Dutch? I think the Dutch were like looking at the coastlines of Australia before mm-hmm. Captain Cook was and stuff like that. There yeah. might have been some interaction there. There was definitely trade between Indonesian countries, maybe China as well, in the north of Australia.
Mm. I'm going to be honest, I don't know much about this. All I know is that like these peoples did have contact with Australia mm. pre-colonization. I know Vikings remains have been found here as well.
Yeah.
God, oh, those guys got Vikings. Everywhere. Vikings? Yeah, Vikings get fucking everywhere. I know there's been at least one Viking ship found here Holy with, like, shit. Burial remains and things.
That's nuts. Wow.
Those guys got fucking all over the world, man. Is there anywhere the Vikings couldn't go? Space?
Jesus Christ. One thing I do want to mention here is the Ponciana woman. Do you know much about the Ponciana woman?
I do not.
This is a great example for, I guess, what I'm trying to get at here. So the Ponciana woman is sort of a folk legend, folk tale that exists in the north of Australia, mainly around Darwin. And it's like a woman in white sort of folk tale, if anyone's familiar with those sorts of tales. The Ponciana mm-hmm. woman is said to be very beautiful, have long dark hair, be wearing white, and be found in the Ponciana trees in a small suburb of Darwin. She's said to be a bit of a La Llorona type, where she might lure men to their deaths or be benevolent, in fact, to be a protective force. There's lots of origins as to who she is, whether she was a young Japanese woman or whether she was an indigenous woman, or how she might have died if she was sexually assaulted or if she was murdered by soldiers, all this sort of stuff. So the Ponciana woman exists, but there's also basically the same myth that exists in Indonesia as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's believed that basically this was one of the theories is that this was sort of a cross-cultural thing that occurred between Indonesian peoples and First Nations Australians, even pre-contact. Mm-hmm. And it's just sort of become part of the cultural lexicon for like this folktale. So that's what I'm trying to get at here is like there might have been like information and knowledge sharing as well as trading, and maybe even like different like magical flora and fauna that was interacting in these like pre-contact Australia. So that's just something to consider and think about. I'd love to hear more from people that maybe know more about that. Yeah. But yeah, that's just
very cool idea. I'm gonna be honest, I don't know a lot about like trade and culture in Australia pre-contact. I just it's not an area that I've ever really studied. I don't know much about it.
Yeah. I'll put a link about the Ponciana woman in the show notes. It's a bit interesting story.
Cool.
Okay. My next point is about colonization conflict. So now we're getting to 1778 and the First Fleet.
So do you have anything for prior to the First Fleet? I'll just briefly explain.
Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't know. So Captain Cook, a massive cunt,
yeah.
Showed up in a boat full of people. He was out exploring the fucking world, trying to find new countries to colonize effectively, and stumbled upon Australia. They sailed up and down the East Coast a bit. Their ship was wrecked. They repaired it. They found Mount Warning.
Yeah.
Various things. Then they went back to Britain, and everyone there was like, you're lying, there's no country there, all these animals you've described are insane and can't possibly exist. And Captain Cook was like, fuck you, I'm right. He went back, found Australia again, this time brought like botanists and artists and stuff to depict the animals that he'd found. They took samples back, and then Britain was like, okay, Australia does exist, sounds like a great place for a new colony where we can dump all of our many criminals, because we keep arresting people for stealing napkins and stuff.
Yeah, we keep arresting people who are like highly impoverished, starving people. We keep arresting them for stealing bread, and
the jails are poor because we made the jails are all full because we made being poor a crime.
Yeah, basically.
So
gosh.
Cool. So then we get the First Fleet, which was the first fleet full of boats, full of convicts to dump here in Australia, who were going to build the colony, settle.
Yep. Yep. So Britain colonizes the land with ships full of Muggle convicts. I'm saying Muggle convicts because this is post Statute of Secrecy. This is after the magical world in Britain and the Muggle world in Britain has been divided. There's no reason why magical people would be in Muggle prisons and would be Muggle convicts sent to a different land.
Yeah, I want to challenge this a little bit.
All right, go nuts.
Because I'm not sure I agree here.
Okay.
So I'm thinking back to our magical lore episode where I was talking about the International Confederation of Wizards and the fact that I think it's Peru where they have the Abominable Snowman or whatever.
Yeah.
They basically, the International Confederation of Wizards basically like sent people in to deal with the Abominable Snowman because the local Peruvian government wasn't like powerful or resourceful enough to deal with it on their own. So they basically just stepped in and took over management of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if I'm... I shouldn't put myself in the shoes of this. Now, if we're looking at the International Confederation of Wizards way back in the 1700s, being like, oh, there's a whole new country here that's just been discovered, which was a thing that was happening at the time.
Yeah.
Why would they either assume that there are no wizards there or decide to do absolutely nothing about it? I think they would have wanted wizards to be on the First Fleet heading over there being like, okay, well, it's time to keep everything secret from Muggles. We need to figure out what's the go here.
I think you could be right, but I like to think that it wasn't an initial decision because ultimately, remember, wizards were keeping out of Muggle business as much as they could. Because remember, if they start to get involved in Muggle issues, then Muggles will want wizards to fix everything, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I just think...
But this isn't a Muggle issue. This is a wizard issue. The issue is, if there are wizards amongst the native population of Australia, which they would assume there is because wizards are everywhere, we need to get over there and teach them the right way to do things, which is to keep all magic secret from Muggles. And if we don't do that, the Muggles who are going over there are going to find out about magic.
Yeah, that's possible. I still think that they could have believed, like, there's not much liaison between Muggles and wizards at this stage, but they could have believed what Muggles believed, which Terra Nullius, the land is empty.
Yeah, that's true.
There are no indigenous people here. And when they do find them, they count indigenous people as part of the fauna of the land. Disgustingly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's, again, for our non-Australian listeners, that's just a horrible part of Australian history. Unlike other countries that were colonized by the British, where they showed up and like, oh, there's native people here. In Australia, they assumed that there were no native people. And then when they found the native people, they're like, these aren't people. These are animals.
Yeah.
A thing that happened for some fucking reason.
I'll get more into that later. But I think I like to think that in the initial, the main colonization, the first fleet of Australia was Muggles. And I think the only magic people would have been people that were born on the journey or people that were like hadn't yet reached magical age. So like Muggleborns, like young children.
Yeah, that weren't identified as wizards.
Maybe some squibs that were like had slipped through the cracks of magical society and were in Muggle society, broke a couple of laws. That's what I tend to think at the initial.
That makes sense to me. If the understanding at the time is that there are no people in this land, it is Terra Nullius, it is completely empty and devoid of people, there would be no reason for wizards to come over here. Unless there just are wizards who want to go and settle a new land, which wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me, but I think majority Muggles.
Yeah, there's going to be very few, if any, magic users amongst that first settlers, colonizers.
So what would happen when large penal colonies encounter the First Nations peoples who are adept magic users, masterful agriculturalists and aquaculturalists who are not threatened by the intense weather events, the confusing natural flora and fauna that's also magical conflict, which is exactly what happened historically, spurred by the fear of the unknown and the British need to expand the colony. But what happens when letters start to be sent back to the mainland detailing the peculiar abilities of the indigenous populations, when they send the body of a Bunyip back to British scientists who think it's a hoax? The Statue of Secrecy is now under threat. So the Minister for Magic, or whoever was in charge of Magical Britain at the time, I don't know if it was a minister, is likely under threat from the International Confederation of Wizards to step in and manage the situation, perhaps even threatening that the Confederation could come in and take over. So if the Minister for Magic is in confidence with King George III or the Muggle Monarch of England at the time, King George III, who was the Muggle Monarch of England at the time, or the statesman William Pitt the Younger, who was the Prime Minister, I think that the course of action would be obvious. The goal of the non-magical English government is to seize this land for conquest and colony. As such, the indigenous peoples of this land were considered an inconvenient obstacle. This was an age in human history where the cultural influence of the Age of Enlightenment, the culture of empire and Darwinism, intermingled horribly, so that the Aboriginal peoples of Australia were viewed as uncivilized, primitive, and a dying race. They were literally described as a dying race from a time of pre-evolution who would, given enough time, would simply just die off and we wouldn't have to worry about them. It was terrible.
Yeah, I don't think the idea that they would die off was happening, like, immediately upon colonization. I think that was later. Because I don't think Darwin was around the 1700s. I think he was later.
Okay.
When was Darwin? Actually, let me look this up. You can keep talking.
So, in fact, Aboriginal people were viewed by the colonising British as a part of the fauna of this land, as I said. And the speedy extermination of this population would, in fact, be helping the natural course of history play out so that Britain could carry on with its merry expansion. So, the goal of magical Britain is to preserve the statue of secrecy, and the Mughal colonisation of Australia puts that secrecy of their civilisation, and in fact the whole wizarding world, at a great risk. The solution seems quite clear. British wizards need to be sent to Australia to colonise the country alongside Muggles, to fight, suppress and kill the indigenous magical peoples, creatures and life of the land, to keep the secret. This was, as we've said before, the most, like, integral and important prerogative of the British government in magical government is to keep the secret. That is what they are there for.
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically the entire function of the government. They do very little governing. It's all about keeping the secret.
So it makes perfect sense to me that, if not at the initial, certainly as soon as possible, once it was realised that Australia was a magical land with magical peoples and flora and fauna, that British wizards were being asked to go there and deal with it.
Thank you for reminding me of Terra Nullius, something that I have forgotten about when I was researching this episode for some fucking reason. Because I kept thinking about this in terms of, like, the British wizards are going to have to come over here and try and, like, not cooperate, but try and, like, impose their system of secrecy upon the magical indigenous peoples, which isn't going to work with the systems of, like, the ways of life here on the country. It just doesn't make any sense. I don't see how it happens. But remembering that people of the time were like, oh, the indigenous Australians are literally animals, they would have just been like, okay, so there's all kinds of magical animals in Australia, such as the platypus, that we need to keep a secret from the Muggles who are colonizing the land. Therefore, going over there and just, like, oppressing, suppressing, getting rid of all of this magical stuff that's loose in the wild. Like, that's our version of colonization that's happening alongside the Muggle colonization. Yeah, and the indigenous peoples, unfortunately, would have just copped the very violent end of that stick.
I think also, like I said, I think the wizards would have been informed before they went there that there are indigenous people there who are magic users. Because
they would have known that, but they just wouldn't have thought of them as people.
They wouldn't have, because they're also influenced by social constructs at the time. So, yeah, that's how I think the colonization began. And so if we just imagine, like, the colonization of this country with the First Fleet and that initial contact, basically it was, and like, we set a content warning at the beginning of this, but another content warning here, we are going to talk about massacres. Like, it was enforced, like, government, government endorsed military action and massacres against the indigenous people to push them out of this land that needs to be built up and developed and colonized. Like, that was what was going on.
That was very much the policy of the time.
In fact, there's often been speculation about whether or not, because obviously on the First Fleet, a lot of the convicts got sick on the voyage. That's just how it happens. So when they arrived in the land, they brought with them things like, I don't know, probably typhoid, smallpox, all sorts of diseases. Some people...
The common cold didn't exist in Australia prior to the First Fleet arriving. And then when it did arrive, like, literally just the common cold and the flu decimated indigenous populations because they had no antibodies against it. It just went through the communities and wiped people out.
There's also been speculation and some evidence that there might have been obviously that's a part of the, it's a part of the warfare, it's a part of the genocide to purposely introduce sicknesses to Indigenous people, because hey, if a common cold wipes them out, let's introduce them to smallpox. Like, it'll clear out that land for our beautiful farms, you know? It's just...
I don't think that was there as an intentional tactic.
It has been argued.
British didn't have... It has been argued by people that are smarter than me, but I don't think the British at the time had the knowledge of germs they would need to come up with germ warfare. But I might be wrong. I could be
wrong. I mean, they'd gone through the Black Plague. They know enough about germs to be able to solve that eventually.
They know about sickness, but... Like, the idea of germs and how sickness is spread is not very well developed at the time.
I don't know. I believe it. I think that it's very possible.
I don't think that's based on anything.
Okay, so that's... another point I wanted to bring up with colonization is we often wonder about the size of the wizarding population in Britain in the 90s, right? And we know that there aren't many wizards, and I wonder if the expansion of the British Empire contributed to that low, low population. Because if you're thinking about the fact that in our history, real history, the British Empire covered, what, 25% of the globe?
Yeah.
If wizards had to be sort of called in and used to expand that empire, to fight off the Indigenous magical peoples, massacre, suppress them, then eventually settle there. Maybe that is another reason why there's just... Because, like, maybe that's another reason why.
That makes
sense. It makes sense.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. So it's not like... Okay. So the Muggles just basically send people out and start living in other countries. I'm vastly simplifying, but whatever. But every time the Muggles discover a new country and send people to live there, wizards have to move in their own contingent to... First of all, figure out what kind of magic shit is in that country, because there's going to be all kinds of different peoples, different systems of magic, and like spells, potions, dragons, magical creatures, magical plants. They have to move in there amongst the Muggles, discover all of that, and it's all going to be completely new and crazy, and then repress it and keep it secret from the Muggles and push it back. Yeah. That means that as the Muggle Empire expands and grows stronger, the wizarding population is going to be shrinking and spreading out thinner and thinner and thinner across the world. Because they have assigned themselves a job, secrecy, which is insane. And requires all of their resources just to tread water, basically.
Yeah. Because we've often talked about, like we said, the British population of wizards. Like, we mentioned it last episode, what, there's like 67 million people in the UK in our real world?
Yeah. Yeah, 67 million and 25 in Australia.
And then we've done the math before on, like, what the global wizarding population would be, and it's, like, less than 0.1% of the global population would be wizards, right? And so, and we know that, like...
But that's based on the numbers from Britain. Yeah. What if Britain has an unusually small number of wizards compared to the rest of the world?
Because of the colonization of the globe. Because, like...
Yeah.
It's just crazy that there's 63 million people in Britain... And then the school that, like, houses all the children in Britain, and also from other countries, it could house people from funny France who don't go to Beauxbatons, has 700 kids in it. Like, we did the math before, and we talked about it in the 90s, about 700 kids. And we know that there was a baby boom for the generation that we were looking at as well, because of the war. So, like...
it's anywhere from 300 to 1,000, but settle on 700.
Yeah. That's insane.
It is a insanely low.
Yeah. Everyone in the wizarding world knows each other. There are, like, distinct families. It makes sense to me. I always, in my head, I guess I always kind of thought of it as, like, oh, the population's low because they've had this huge war, but it's not good enough. It's not, there's no reason for it to be that low unless wizards are just not good at, like, passing on their wizard genes or whatever you want to say. But, like, to me, it really seems like maybe colonization is the answer we've been looking for this whole time. That sounds like a grim sentence out of context. maybe the historical colonization and the expansion of the British Empire looked through in a magical lens answers that age-old question that we've been pondering forever as to why there's so few wizards in Britain. That's better phrased.
Love that you felt the need to explain that. What I really like about that is kind of like a cause and effect thing. I like that as the Muggle British Empire grows stronger and bigger, it weakens the magical population there by spreading them out. I love that. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of explaining away the population discrepancy, which we've been struggling with for years, like, it does it.
Makes sense.
That makes sense to me.
Okay.
I don't know exactly what it means for the numbers in other countries, because, like, every single time we have tried to extrapolate the magical population, we've done it by pulling from the numbers in Britain. So if the numbers in Britain are disproportionate to the rest of the world as a result of colonization, I don't know what that means to the rest of the world.
It might mean that there's way more wizards than we even considered. It might be, it mightn't be like 0.01%. It might be more like 5%. Really?
Yeah. That's
a huge jump. But it's possible.
It is possible. Yeah.
Yeah. And colonization, as we know, like, it was about like the few suppressing and ruling over the many, like divide and conquer. It would make sense if you had like a small population of British wizards coming in and contributing to that colonization of that country.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just thins them out, like you said. There is, yeah, okay, wow.
Yeah, well, it just makes sense. Like, if we're assuming that the magical population of Australia at the time is the magical population of the indigenous population, yeah, plus the British ones that have come over, like, there's just going to be more people here. Because there are more people here.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah. So, that's the first two like, cultural touchstones in history that I had there. We can sort of picture in our minds what would have happened over the next next century. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, forced expansion, colonization, massacres, attempted genocides, all these sorts of things happening between the First Nations people and the settlers. Next point I want to look at is a gold rush. I don't like a gold rush, personally. I remember, like, when we had to learn about the gold rush in school. It's an interesting point in history, but I always kind of find it unnerving. So,
That's interesting. Yeah, I always found it very interesting to learn about. I actually am a little bit refreshed on this because I just went on a road trip with our parents across the shipwreck coast in southern Australia and hit up a bunch of the old gold rush towns around here. So
that's interesting.
I'm a little bit refreshed on this. I was just at the Eureka Stockade, the birthplace of Australian government.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we'll touch on that.
So the gold rush. In the 1850s, the gold rush of Australia saw a huge immigration to this country that really put the land on the global map into the global consciousness. Mm. There was a...
Hey, this country isn't just huge and full of weird animals. There's resources here. There's
money.
There's gold to be had. Don't you want to come to our new country now? Yeah. Yes, said the rest of the world.
There was a...
We love gold and stealing from native people.
Yeah. There was a large influx of immigrants from Europe, East Asia, South Asia. Sorry, from Europe, East Asia, South Asia, and Southeast Asia. Plenty of working class people traveling to Australia for a chance of striking gold, quite literally. In 1851, the white population of Australia, I say that because Indigenous people were not counted in this population count.
Yeah, we have no way to know these numbers. They just were never counted.
The white population of Australia was around 450,000. That is nothing. 450,000.
That's so low.
And then in 20 years' time, by the end of the gold rush...
That's like the global population of wizards.
I know. In 20 years' time, by the end of the gold rush in 1871, the population had tripled to more than 1.7 million. That's an insane boom.
That's more than tripled. That's almost quadrupled.
Yeah. 20 years.
Wow. Yeah, that's huge.
And with that, think of the urbanization that comes with that too. Like, think of Melbourne before the gold rush, and then think of it afterwards. It's got trams. Like, there's no horses and carts anymore. Like, it's... Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There were gold rush towns.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whole
yeah, sections.
Whole civilizations were built around places where there were gold, because it's not like you could just live out there in a tent and rip gold out of the ground. Like, you had to have an entire economy and infrastructure to support you. Yeah. Yeah. Our country was built on gold rushes.
Yeah. And also, it's a big part of, like, the promise of Australia as well. Like, for the colonizing folks, the promise of Australia, obviously, not the prisoners, but the other folks that came along to colonize the country, the promise was, like, oh, you'll get your own land that you can own and you can toil it. And, like, it'll be hard work. Yeah. Like, don't get us wrong. It'll be hard work. But you'll be the owner of your own property. You'll be a free man. you'll have riches and, like, wealth and prosperity and free rights, basically. And that's pretty good. You're thinking about your fucking flavorless stew in England in this dirty-ass street, you're like, oh, actually, that promise seems pretty good, you know?
Yeah. Literally, this is a line from our national anthem.
Yeah.
With golden soil and wealth for toil.
Yeah.
Like, literally, like, we are a golden country where you can come and make money and build a life for yourself by working for it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the promise of Australia.
So, if I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about this from a magical perspective, I was thinking, like, mm-hmm. wizards from around the globe may be interested in gold for currency, alchemy, and riches. Goblins may mm-hmm. be interested in gold and any other minerals that could be found in this land. Mm-hmm. And in this process, I wonder what other magical minerals and valuables may end up being extracted from the land.
Yeah.
Because as we've discussed in our magical land episode, we've said that magic was palpable here because we've had the oldest mm-hmm. civilization living here for plus 60,000 years. Yeah. The very earth itself would have magical properties, I would think. Like, you could pick up the soil and it would slip through your fingers and it would feel like magic. Like,
yeah. Well, you talked about how Australia's biggest export at the moment is coal.
Yes.
Yeah. And like I said, Australia was built on gold mines. I also mentioned opal mines last episode. Like, Australia is very, very wealthy in terms of natural resources in the land, which can be extracted. Mining is a huge industry here.
Yes. Huge.
Huge.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's something interesting. I guess, like, I'm just thinking about, like, wizards coming over in the gold rush, because mm-hmm. like, it's just such a weird thing to imagine, like, because obviously wizards could find gold so much easier, right? They could stand over the ground and mm-hmm. say Accio gold and move it through the mm-hmm. earth towards them. Because I actually I looked it up when I was studying, like, when I was researching for this episode, like, was there a lot of gold here? And I'm like, yeah, there's like A bit of gold. There was a pretty good amount of gold. Like, I was always under the impression that there wasn't much gold here, that it was more of, like, a rumor that went insane.
No, what it was that people were under the impression that, like, you could literally just sort of bend down into the dirt and dig around a little bit and pull out gold nuggets, and then you'd be rich and you'd be set. That wasn't the case.
Yeah.
What it was that, like, there was a lot of gold, but you could move out here and make a claim on the land and mine that claim for your entire life and never find
anything. Exactly, yeah, yeah, yeah.
While the person 30 feet from you with their own claim could be strike a line of gold and be a millionaire.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah. And also, it was kind of a fucking scam moving out into the gold fields because the people who got rich during the gold rush were not the miners.
No.
It was the people who owned the land, first of all.
The settlers.
And it was also, it was the shopkeepers.
Yeah.
It was the people who sold the deed to your mining claim. It was the tax collectors.
Yeah.
It was the government who got massively, massively rich during that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because they basically just charged exorbitant rates for everything that you needed to mine, including a license to mine,
mm-hmm.
and medicine, and food, and everything that you needed. And people with nothing came to, let's just say, the Eureka the town.
Yeah.
And spent years mining, and everything they pulled out of the ground, which could have been quite worthwhile, could have been real gold, they could have made a fortune, they had to spend on just staying here and paying for themselves and their families to live. And then at the end, it's like, well, I can't go anywhere else because I didn't make any money, so now I live here.
Yep. It was a con to get more people in the country.
Yeah. And it worked.
It worked.
And yeah, as you said, there were lots and lots of migrant workers from other countries. People who came here hoping to make money for their family and send money back to their family, who sometimes could, but mostly didn't, and ended up either stuck here or made money to bring their families over and then just made a life as a farmer or whatever after the gold rush had died down.
Yeah. Something I often think about with the gold rush is, like, this was a kind of a big moment for cross-cultural communication, like, outside, obviously, the initial conflict settler wars. But basically there was a huge influx of people immigrating from China to come into the gold rush to start businesses and mine themselves. So that was, like, sort of the mostly the beginning of Chinese immigration to Australia, and that's one of our hugest immigration populations now. So I think about, like, you know, the new cultures of magic, the new kinds of magical spells, magical creatures that might have been introduced during this time as well, from Asia Pacific, yeah. Indonesia, China. Like, I think it'd just be interesting. Yeah. That's the gold rush, unless you have anything else you wanted to add.
Yeah, well, I feel like I should talk about the Eureka Stockade a little bit, because I mentioned it.
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah, so the Eureka Stockade, it was something that happened at, like, the biggest gold field and the biggest gold mine in Victoria, which is the small southern state where I live, where Melbourne is, one of the major cities in Australia.
Yeah.
And the site of many of this gold rush was in the low southern part of Australia, in Victoria.
Yeah.
So the Eureka Stockade, basically what happened is, as you've said, there was a massive, massive, massive population boom. And prior to this, the majority of Australia's population was convicts and settlers who were either sent here because they had no choice or nowhere else to go, or sort of came here for various reasons and then couldn't get back to Britain, even though they wanted to, and were just sort of stuck here. So there was a small, unhappy population controlled by colonizers and settlers who were here to be in charge and had a lot of power. And then the population tripled or quadrupled very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Full of people who wanted to be here, who cared about being here, who wanted to make a life here, who brought their families with them. And all of a sudden you had, like, an actual population.
Yeah.
So a massive, massive influx of people into the country. And then they were put into these terrible, terrible conditions. The conditions of the goldfields were awful, awful stuff. People were dying of illness and disease and being beaten to death by the cops and being starved out of house and home. Not they had houses. They were fucking camping in the dirt and shit.
Yeah.
So it was a huge, oppressed population. And what happened at Eureka was basically the miners and their families unionized, effectively.
Yeah.
They all banded together and they're like, this place is shit. The amount of tax that we're being charged to be here just trying to dig for gold in this place is unreasonable. We're all going to die, effectively, because we can't afford to pay to be here when we shouldn't have to pay to be here in the first place.
Yeah.
And something happened called the Eureka Stockade, where they basically, all of the miners, like, built a stockade, armed themselves with weapons, and basically said, come and kill us if you want our money. We're not giving it to you anymore.
Yeah.
This is our country. We're here. And this was the birthplace. It's called the birthplace of Australian democracy, because it was the first time that a bunch of Australians, self-identified Australians, not, like, English settlers, English colonizers, actually banded together and rebelled against the English people and said, no, like, this is our country, this is our place, we're standing up for what we want, here are our demands, effectively, and, like, fought for our country. And it was about Australia as an actual country, not as a colony of the British.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a terrible massacre, the Eureka Stockade. It failed. Completely failed.
Yes.
Completely failed. They were bulldozed by the British.
But the legend just lived on.
Killed them all. But the legend lived on. Yeah. And it was the birthplace. It was the beginning of Australia wanting to be a country on its own, wanting to have its own political systems, its own laws, its own governance, and not to be ruled by the British, effectively.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense that that desire for a democracy and its own country and its own politicization, as you said, was sort of built around this idea of a fair go.
A fair go.
Which is such an Australian concept. Money.
Yeah, and the idea that, like, I want to come here and work for my own wealth and the wealth of my family and not for the wealth of a king or a queen that I have no loyalty to.
Yes.
Especially seeing so many of these people immigrated in from places that were not Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, why do I give a shit about the king or queen of the time?
And I imagine there was also a bunch of people in that Eureka Stockade that were born in Australia post the contact. And so, like, had grown up in this country, never known England, never known a monarch. Interesting.
There was a very big cultural shift from people who were sent here against their will versus people who were born here and knew no other place and knew no other home.
That's a big divide.
I'm not sure what that means in terms of magical Australia.
maybe if we're mirroring again, maybe it was the start of a more Australian magical political scene, like an Australian ministry. Like maybe there was like beginnings of that, because obviously at that point, I imagine it still would have been the British ministry was like in charge, and the wizards that are being sent there and the wizards that have been born there are still compliant to the rules of the British ministry, right? Statute of secrecy, blah, blah, blah.
Well, something that we haven't touched on, because this is really, really school relevant, but I was thinking that when, like, wizards started coming over here, when the original colonizing wizards started coming over here, their children, I imagine, would have been sent back to Britain to attend Hogwarts.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what the original colonizers did. They, yeah, the wealthy ones, sent their children back to England to be educated in the institutions there.
Yeah.
So I think this massive influx of people, this is when Australia started being like, actually, we kind of need our own resources and
We need our own government. Like, we need our own economy and school. And,
yeah. We can't be dependent on Britain, and we can't be... Britain is a leech feeding off us. Mm. And, like, we need our own shit here. So... if there was a Hogwarts-style school in Australia, which, spoiler alert, we don't think there is, this is the inception of it. It's when all of these people moved into the gold fields and started building their own lives here.
Yeah.
That's when Australia started.
Magical Australia. Like...
yeah.
Yeah, that's when they're thinking, like, oh, you know, why should the wealthy wizards be able to send their children off to Scotland to go get educated, and the rest of us have to homeschool our children when we're trying to, you know, make a living and make our lives here? Like, no, let's just start our own Hogwarts here in Australia. Like, I can 100% see that conversation happening with wizards.
We'll touch on that more in our school episode, but this is the point where Australia started realizing that we had to be our own country.
Yes. Okay.
And it would be a long time before independence from the British, and I say that in quotes because we're still not independent.
We're not independent.
We're still a British colony.
Yeah.
Our country is still technically the Commonwealth of Australia. Okay, let's move away from goldfields now.
Okay, the next point I have here is genocide continued. So... all right. In history, we know that the expansion of the colony into the formation of a state and a nation had to incorporate the building of a national identity, culture, and history.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely imperative to the formation of this national identity was the upholding of a white Australia.
Mm-hmm.
In white Australia, it was the triumph of British civilization that had conquered this land, tamed this wild and harsh landscape, and built a society that promised prosperity and the concept of a fair go for British and Europeans settling the country.
Mm-hmm.
But really, what the creation of a national identity and a lawful federation meant was the completion of the conquest of the Australian natural resources and the Indigenous population.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, Indigenous peoples were cast out from their lands, which were turning into urban centres and settler properties. Settlers also massacred First Nations peoples to clear the land for agriculture or urbanisation, mm-hmm. to seize control of their state-given property, or on instruction from government and law enforcement. State and territory governments were concerned that Aboriginal people were still too populous, and also they were racist.
Mm-hmm.
They viewed Aboriginal people and populations as lesser than, as addicted populations, and as lazy.
Mm-hmm.
I say addicted populations, I should give context here. The colonizing forces basically introduced alcohol to the Aboriginal people and then blamed the Aboriginal people for becoming addicted to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a hint towards a much larger and more complicated issue that's still a thing today. But essentially that is what happened.
Yeah. Essentially, the governments didn't see Aboriginal people as conducive members of the workforce, and this was detrimental to the expansion of the colony and the building of a federation. And mm-hmm. so they started to come up with ways to control the Aboriginal population. These actions were a few of the moving parts that made up the attempted genocide of the First Nations people. Mm-hmm. Other important components of the Australian government's state-sanctioned genocide of Aboriginal peoples was the actions taken to, quote, breed out the black, unquote. Mm-hmm. So... when I say black, this is something that often confuses a lot of American people.
Mm-hmm.
There are black people in Australia. Indigenous Australians, First Nations peoples, Aboriginal people identify as black.
Yeah.
There's often the spelling as well, B-L-A-K, no C, because the mm-hmm. C is for colonization. So, yeah, black people exist. It's not just African American people. It's not just black people. Existing in an American context, there are other ways.
In Australia, black is not synonymous with African American.
No.
So. Yeah, and it's not a word that Jem and I have chosen to use. It's a word that Indigenous peoples have claimed and chosen to use to describe themselves. Yeah. Okay. So, according to my understanding of history, this was where the Darwinism stuff was coming in, not earlier on.
I think it was... from when I did Australian history in university, I think it existed... Or when was Darwin born? When was he around? Can you...
So I looked him up. He was born in early 1800s and was around until late 1800s. Okay. And I think his theories were like mid-1800s.
So definitely the Age of Enlightenment was having an effect on the colonization of Australia, because there was that view that obviously Indigenous peoples, people that were black, were lesser than. But yeah. I think Darwinism really did number on that later on.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if this is distinctive to Australia, if this was something worldwide. But when Charles Darwin was... Origin of the Species?
Yeah, that's
the one. Whatever his theory was called. When that came out and he started talking about the survival of the fittest, what white people, especially in Australia, I don't know if it was worldwide or if it was just Australia, what they took that to mean was that white people were the fitter species, the better, stronger, smarter, more powerful species. And non-white people were not that. They were weaker, lesser, blah, blah, blah. And they were, like, fated to just sort of naturally die out because white people more evolved. And as far as I understood, Darwin was very much like, no, you've completely misunderstood everything that I said. First of all, that's not how fitter works. It's about fitting into your environment, not being stronger. But whatever. So there was a social theory at the time, basically, that all of the Indigenous people were just going to naturally die out.
Yeah.
And us merciful white people were going to, like, shepherd them away to, like, private little areas where they could just quietly die away from the general... Reservations. We're going to take them off their native lands and put them somewhere else and let them quietly die there.
Yeah. Where we don't have to interact with them, and they're not on our lands that we own.
Yeah, and by the grace of God, they'll fade into the light. They'll fade into the darkness, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Everything's great. And then several decades pass and they didn't just die out, because that's not what anything means or how anything works. So then it was like, okay, well, we should help them along. And that was where the Stolen Generations and the idea of breeding out the black came in.
Yeah. Assimilation into white culture.
Yeah.
Because basically a bunch of colonizers and settlers and terrible racist scientists came to the conclusion that when Aboriginal people... have children with white people, probably from sexual assault.
Yeah.
Due to the colonization, that the children are more fairer and in complexion.
Yeah.
So they basically theorized, oh, well, if we just basically remove children from their cultures, raise them in a white society, have them married off to white people, they won't, their children won't be Indigenous, and their children's children won't be Indigenous, and et cetera, and et cetera.
Yeah, and, like, it was very much, like, the introduction of whiteness to the Indigenous peoples will make them smarter, stronger, better, blah, blah, blah.
But more at the conducive to a capitalist federation society.
Yeah, at the moment, all of these half-breeds are obviously still terrible and lesser and still need to be oppressed and horribly abused and assaulted. But eventually, over the generations, as we breed out the badness, they'll become good. And I know that this is not just an Australian idea. I know this has happened the world over. But this was a very terrible policy at the time. It was an official policy.
Yeah, it went from the mid-1800s to the 1970s. So living memory.
The 70s.
Yeah. This was a government action to control the Indigenous populations of Australia. And in case anyone doesn't know, the United Nations defines one of the mechanisms of genocide as trying to control the population of a people. So it was essentially to wipe Indigenous people out. First Nations children were taken from their homes, their families, and their lands, and placed in institutions or in the homes of white families to be fostered. They were re-educated, indoctrinated, and abused, taught to hate their own culture, language, and Aboriginal identity. This attempted genocide of our First Nations people is in living memory. There are currently more than 17,000 Stolen Generation survivors in Australia. Over one-third of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are their descendants. In Western Australia, almost half of the population have Stolen Generations links. The effects of the Stolen Generations is generational trauma and a disconnection from country and culture. It's very possible there are Australians walking around today who don't know that a few generations back, their grandparent or ancestor was stolen from their land and family and raised to assimilate into a white Australian culture. There are plenty of stories of people not realising they are Indigenous, instead thinking they are white Australian, or that they are descendant of South Asian or Polynesian cultures instead of Aboriginal. If we are making the argument that real-world history is reflected in a magical context, then it follows that this attempted genocide would have taken place, and magical First Nations people would have been subjected to it as well.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So, this is the worst thing that's ever happened in Australian history.
Yeah.
The stolen generations. It's the greatest. I keep wanting to say tragedy, but, like, tragedy isn't the right word because it implies a tragedy lack of agency.
Exactly, yeah. Assault. Yeah. Attack.
Genocide. You said the right word for it. It's the most horrible thing that's happened. And, God, those numbers. 17,000 people, one third of the population. God.
Of Western Australia, specifically.
Western Australia, God, yeah. So, in our last episode when we were talking about, and maybe earlier in this episode, I've kind of lost track a bit, we were talking about Indigenous peoples, how there were thousands of different peoples and there were different languages and there were specific people living on specific land and the connection between land and people was like incredibly culturally and spiritually significant. This is where we see the severing of many of those ties. Because people were taken from their lands and then lost all connection to their peoples and their families, so they didn't even know where they came from.
Yeah.
And this is how languages disappeared and peoples disappeared. And I say disappeared, were wiped out, were destroyed.
Yeah.
Because the connections were severed.
Eroded.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, hard to even think about. For me, a white Australian with absolutely no connection to it and no reason to mourn for myself. Yeah. Hard to even think or talk about. It's horrible. Yeah. Horrible stuff.
Like, I've seen this happen at least twice in my personal life, where someone who thought that they belonged to one culture actually found out that they are Indigenous and they just didn't know because their family was stolen and they were just raised to think differently. It's living memory. It's very common. It's a part of, it's a dark, dark part of our history that we couldn't not address. It's terrible.
Yeah. And now to take this horrible real life tragedy and translate it into a whimsical children's series. I kind of just want to skim over this because it's honestly too grim to really translate. Magical populations would have gone through the same thing, I guess. Been swept up in this, lost a connection to land. We said that a lot of their magic was tied to land and to culture. So a decimation of magical knowledge and practice among the Indigenous populations. It would have survived in places and in peoples because not everyone was stolen. There are still people on their traditional land living their traditional lives in families that not were untouched but survived this genocide.
There were First Nations families that managed to hide their children. Maybe not all their children. The fairer children were taken and assimilated. But there were First Nations families that adapted and survived and protected their children from being taken. So those people that belong, magical users that belong to those environments would have been raised and culturally connected and spiritually and magically connected to their own cultures and families and lands. But there would be plenty that would completely removed and
would have no connection to that and have no knowledge of their pre-existing connection to that. So all of their magical knowledge would be colonized. It would be the white people's knowledge. It would be the equivalent of what they're taught at the equivalent of Hogwarts, which we'll touch on.
Well, I even think that, I don't know, would white magical wizards be including Indigenous children who are magical in their practices, or would they just be leaving them to be raised in a white muggle society? Would they just be creating obscuri everywhere?
Well,
I think it's maybe 50-50. Like, it depends on the person.
No, like, I don't think so. Because the racism of the time would be like, let's just leave them out. But you've got to remember that wizards' primary driving thing is not racism.
Secrecy.
It's not racism against the different races as we perceive them. It's racism against muggles and mudbloods and stuff. and secrecy. That's their driving force. So I think they want the indigenous magic users, but it would be the same idea of stealing and breeding out the black. It's the, we want to take the indigenous magic users and their indigenous magical systems, destroy those, and indoctrinate them into our British magical systems. Give them wands, teach them spells, teach them the right way
English,
to do magic.
Teach them Latin, all that bullshit.
And obviously, you know, they're so uncivilized and terrible, they can't possibly live up to our greatness, but eventually over the generations we'll get something that's like halfway decent. That would be the thinking of the time.
This is really grim, but I honestly could see these children, these stolen children, being used as akin to house elves, if there's no house elves in this country at this time.
That's exactly what happened during the actual stolen generation. They were used as servants and slaves.
Domestic servants, slavery. That was all happening. So I can see that happening in a magical context. I can see that there might be some situations where white wizarding families don't want to take in an indigenous magical child, and so they just leave them to their own devices, and that child becomes an obscurae. I can see that happening. So I think there's multiple things happening here.
Yeah, we should specify that as well. Stolen Generations wasn't just about race. It was about economy as well. You could steal these children and then have slaves, free workers. That was another aspect to it.
In the state that we're from, like in the area that we're from, the majority of the girls that were stolen were of, I hate to use the word, but breedable age. So they started at age 11.
That's not just our area, that's everywhere.
Yeah, they started at age 11 and 14, and they just took the girls and their families then because they knew it was about population control, but it was also about economy. Yeah, they put them in domestic servitude roles and just knew that, like, oh well, when these girls start getting pregnant, they'll have white babies and all this sort of stuff. It's just
because they will be being impregnated by the white people who have them and control them.
Yeah, exactly.
This was I can't say this with 100% certainty, and I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure Stolen Generations disproportionately affected women and girls because they were stolen and taken for this reason.
I'm not sure if that's true, but it also wouldn't surprise me because it was a huge part of it was about the breeding population and all that sort of stuff. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was more a little bit more targeted towards girls, but I don't know. So my last point here is, where are we now? Because if we're talking about history, we have
that was grim.
Let's take a moment. That was really grim.
That was rough. Like,
we had to talk about it, but I hated to talk about it.
If we're going to talk about Australia's history, like, this is the most significant thing to talk about, race relations in Australia. That's what we have to talk about. It sucks to try and consider it from a magical point of view because it's annoying to take real life tragedies and filter them through the lens of a fucking children's book about wizards, but that is the premise of what we're doing here.
Yeah, if we're going to be thinking about things like a magical society or a magical land or a magical school, then we can't not talk about the effects of this attempted genocide.
Yeah.
Because it's going to affect everything.
Yeah. We can't talk about a magical school in Australia without considering the children in Australia who will be attending those schools and how in the 1970s they were still being stolen. They're probably still being stolen today. I just don't know enough about it.
Well, yeah, there's more Indigenous children being stolen from their families today than ever before.
Okay, perfect.
Due to incarceration and foster and all that sort of awful system and the abuse of children that happens in that, especially Indigenous children. That's
social
a whole
services,
other conversation.
We were trying to get away from this grim stuff.
Okay.
There's a reason why I opened this episode with a long conversation about the way that the magical books are broken and you can't fix racism in the series that fixing it in the world, which doesn't fix it in the series. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So
where are we now?
Where are we now? Yeah, we can't talk about history without having consideration of how this creates our present and possibly our future. So where are we now in a post-Sorry Day society? Historically and naturally, Australia, this is my opinion, Australia is at a reckoning point. Mm-hmm. There are natural disasters. There's more diversity now than ever in our human population. Like, I think our last census revealed that the majority of the population of Australia, for the first time since like the 1850s or whatever, the majority of us have at least one parent who was born overseas.
Mm.
There's talk of a referendum about getting an Indigenous voice to Parliament. There's a more widespread understanding of violence in our communities, and when I say violence I mean things like domestic violence, sexual violence, abuse, and how this disproportionately affects Indigenous people, mm-hmm. women, people with disabilities. Like, there's just more of a social awareness, I think, happening in the last couple of years in Australia. So I think Australia is at a very interesting point in our history. So let's think about all these aspects in a magical context, because that's what this is.
What this is about. Yeah.
What is the direction? What's Australia's magical future and present looking like? What's it shaping up to be?
Yeah, there's generally a shift that is occurring at the moment. And I think this is worldwide as well. I don't think this is distinct to Australia.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, we are becoming more socially aware of the issues that exist today and the ones that have existed in history. Like, we're relearning that what we were taught in school was actually not correct. Yeah. And even things like us opening this series with an acknowledgement of country. Acknowledgement of country and welcome to country was definitely not something that was standard when I was growing up. It was not something that we were aware that we needed to do, aside from various special occasions such as an Anzac Day or something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas now it's pretty standard. Like,
yeah. Now, like, people are going, like, when they put a picture on Instagram, they're tagging the location not as Canberra, but as Ngunnawal mm-hmm. country, or like they're putting the country and the land that they're standing on and stuff like that. Like, it's become more socially aware, more normalized mm-hmm. to know what country you're standing on and to be appreciative of the people that belong to that country.
Yeah, there is more awareness. Like, it's illegal to climb on Uluru now, where a few years ago it wasn't, and that was a hot button topic at the time.
Yeah.
We are becoming more aware of the land and sacred sites within the land than we were even a few decades ago.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't want to say all of this to be like, and things are good now, and we're moving in the right direction, because I'm sure that there are about 1,000 injustices and things that I'm not even aware of.
Yeah.
I know that, like, so many more Indigenous people are disproportionately incarcerated and die mm-hmm. in incarceration than white Australians.
Raise the age.
Or any other population.
Yeah, yeah. The age of incarceration for Indigenous, for children in this country, it specifically targets Indigenous children, but the age of incarceration is so much younger than other countries around the world, and that disproportionately affects Indigenous children.
Yeah. There's a land back movement to try and give Indigenous peoples their land back, which is being met with a truly ridiculous amount of resistance from anyone who's not Indigenous. There's all kinds of things going on.
Yeah.
What was the question that you asked?
Where are we now? Like, are we at a reckoning point? I mentioned natural disasters as well. I think this has been a big one, especially in the last couple of years. This is one that's finally affected middle-class white people. Mm. You know, it's one of those issues.
Finally.
Yeah. It's one of those issues that, like, the youth and, like, Indigenous people and rural people have been complaining for ages about how climate change is a problem. But then now suddenly people in Sydney have been experiencing floods for, like, the last 3 years in a row. Mm-hmm. And bushfires have ravaged the entire country. And, like, it's actually starting to catch the attention of wealthy white Australians. And so now it's become an issue that's, like, I know it's annoying that I had to do that to actually take any action. But it does give me a little bit of hope that the majority of people are more conscious of the effects of climate change and the damage mm-hmm. that's being done to our natural environment, and that has affected the way people vote, that has affected the way people talk about our natural resources and our trade and stuff like that. It's interesting.
Yeah. Climate change is definitely becoming a bigger and more widely talked about topic.
Because, like, it's become palpable.
Even things like a couple of years ago when the country was on fire, and I say the country was on fire, like a third of the country was on fire. There was insane bushfires that year. Whereas we've had devastating bushfires before, Ash Wednesday, Black Friday, they were always in specific areas with, like, a specific range of devastation. This was different. The entire country was burning for a long, long time because we couldn't control the fires because there was too many of them. Yeah. And like you said, like, koalas are functionally extinct now. They're not extinct, but because so much of their land and their resources burned, koalas are extinct because they can't survive the devastation. Things like that are big topics that people are aware of and people are talking about now. I would love to say that this is going to lead to greater change and things are going to get better. And I want to be hopeful for the future, but I'm a millennial. I look at things through a doomed kind of lens. I think the world's already over and we're just not realizing it yet.
I have hope because I have to. Like, whenever I'm feeling particularly down, I just remember the Bandicoots. This is such a specific thing, but Bandicoots are like this little rat that is like this Australian native rat thing. And
it's
basically
like a little possum rat thing.
Yeah, it's
cute.
Just a cute little rat thing. It's just it lives amongst the Spinifex and the Outbacks. It's just a little dude. And like a couple of years ago, I was watching a nature documentary, David Attenborough one about Australia, and he mentioned that like there was less than like 100 bandicoots left in the wild because of the effects of like agriculture and all this stuff. And I burst into tears. I was at a very vulnerable moment. I burst into tears. But then this year, the University, I think, of New South Wales, maybe it was a different university, correct me if I'm wrong, they've been doing this amazing bandicoot program, and they've reintroduced the bandicoots to the wild again because they've managed to breed them up enough so they can go back in the wild again. And the bandicoots are in the wild again. There's more bandicoots. And same with the Tassie Devils, you know, the COVID vaccine fixed the Tassie Devils. Now they're not going endangered anymore. Like, there's a lot of insane, incredible things happening. So I have to have hope. And whenever I feel particularly down and sad and depressed and morbid, I just think of the bandicoots and maybe I'll actually get the bandicoots tattooed on me or something like that, so I can just look at the bandicoot and be like, oh, there we go. Like,
that's good. Beautiful. In terms of magical Australia, I feel like talking about where we are now is a conversation that we're going to have in our culture episode.
Yeah.
I feel like that's where we're going to talk about, like, what magical Australia looks like now. Where are the people? What are they doing? What are they like?
Yeah.
What birds deliver their mail? That kind of thing.
Yeah,
so I don't have much to say in terms of magical stuff right now because I don't think that's covered by magical history.
Yeah.
So I'll save my thoughts.
I think this deep dive into magical history has given us a very good idea of like what ancient Australia looked like pre-contact, what happened to it post-contact, with the effect of colonization, attempted genocide, the immigration and how that might have affected the land and the people. And I think it's given us a good sort of roadmap to work on so that when we come up with questions later on about culture and school, we can be like, oh, well, let's just think back to this point in history or this thing about land and we can just connect the dots, you know? So I think that's been good.
I think for me, this episode was never about like, and how will we completely reimagine the Australian history, but with wizards there? Because like I said at the beginning of the episode, that was never what we were trying to do. And it's never what Harry Potter has tried to do.
Yeah.
It was about establishing for ourselves and also for our listeners, what is the Australian magical historical context? And now that we have all of that information and all of the information of land, we can start to build an understanding of what the Australian magical world is like now in the present.
Yeah.
And without this episode going through history and the other episode going through land and environment, that episode of what is Australian of what is Australian culture like would have been 6 hours long.
And it also would have been such like a tip of the iceberg conversation because we would have just been making a bunch of references and cultural assumptions that make sense to us, but would have been like the nuance would have been lost on international listeners or listeners who aren't aware of the history of this country. So great.
Okay. Well, I've done it.
I have been Gem, and sovereignty was never ceded, and truth-telling and the spirit of reconciliation is important for the history of this country and the connection to our country and our peoples in it. So thank you all for listening, and please go educate yourself more on the history of this country and its people. That's all I have to say.
I've been Rhea, and after you finish educating yourself about the history of our land and its peoples, please remember to Google a picture of a bandicoot to cheer yourself up because they are incredibly cute.
Thanks for listening. If you want to support us or get in touch, the links to our social media and Patreon are in the show notes. Please feel free to send us so many messages that we go mad and run away to a hut on a rock in the middle of the sea just to avoid them. You'll hear from us again in 2 weeks' time.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.